The title of the talk is The Still Small Voice, which in the language of the Tanakh, the Bible, is Kol Tzmama Daka. What we've been doing here, whether we know it or not, or whatever we assess our experience, is actually step by step building sensitivity and awareness. We're allowing more of our life experience to be included into each moment of awareness. We're less restrictive. Things that we wouldn't notice otherwise are now coming into awareness. The breathing, the body, the flowers on the side of the road, the moments of touching nature, of the taste of the food, things that we normally just censor out by habituation. They're not interesting, they're too small, they're too irrelevant. But at the same time, as we open our sensitivity and open our awareness and give space to our inner life, some voices inside get louder. And they're normally voices, and sometimes they're voices which we don't want to hear. The fears, the insecurity, and often simply the obsessive patterns of the mind that seems to turn in endless loops and generating its own relatives, every thought generating 10 babies, and each of them generating another 10 babies, and each of them, and they all look the same. And that Krishnamurti once said a very nice thing. He said, a thought chasing its own tail, can you realize that this is silly? Can thought realize this is silly and stop? So our thought chases its tail. And so sometimes this carries a lot of emotion, sometimes this carries difficulty and pain, and sometimes it's simply generating stuff because it's used to doing that all the time, a kind of interpretation of the world which our mind feels is necessary for our survival. It's a big question whether it's necessary for our survival. I think we're a lot better without it, but that's our strategy for survival. But some of the feelings are really quite strong. And anxiety could come up, and anger could come up, and judgment, self-judgment is very common. Why am I like this, and why I'm no good at this, and I'm no good anyway, and I'm small, and they're all looking at me, and 100 other kinds of thoughts of judgment, for example. And sometimes these voices can be very overwhelming. And not in every case, but sometimes. And here we have a kind of a kind of balance going on, in which if our mindfulness and steadiness is strong enough, then we can hold the strength and power of some of these loud voices. And if our mindfulness is not so strong, then they overwhelm us and we're inside them. So in a way, the work that we're doing in the first days of the retreat to build a sense of being a watcher of reality. We are being the watcher, that's so fair, the observer of reality, willing and able to take anything as it comes, willing and able to just to hold our world moment by moment, minute by minute. So as we build that steadiness, we have more power to be able to take strong things when they arise in our consciousness. And if we have less steadiness, concentration and ability to receive all this stuff, they will tend to, or they can, overwhelm us. And just to know that that's the fact of the practice, and it changes, and it can be like this one day and like that another day, but that tends to be the balance here. The fact is that the large, the strong voices tend to be voices that carry pain. And it just tends to be like that, because life tends to be an issue of survival, an issue of suffering. Being alive is not that easy. Doesn't matter whether you're an ant or a human being, being alive is a struggle. And it sometimes seems very unfair. We're born, we didn't ask to be born, we're kind of dropped into this world, and minding our own business, and along comes disease and people shouting at us and parents telling us what to do and schools that tell us we shouldn't be free and society that tells us we have to have a career, and actually all of that is internalized and becomes kind of constricting, and these are the voices that we hear. And very often, if we don't look carefully, we'll blame life for this. We'll say life is a bitch. Life is really terrible. My life is especially terrible. And we put the blame on life. And we don't see how we've internalized the struggle. It sits in us like scars from a battleground, and we don't realize how much we've been battling inside, and we have the scars. And usually what happens with scars is that we avoid them because we don't want them to be touched. You know how you have an old wound, you just don't want to be touched. You want to avoid the pain, you don't want to be reminded of pain. So basic strategy after that is to put the pain in compartments, leave the scars alone and avoid them. But scars cause us problems, whether it's in the body or in the mind. And in a sense, we have a duty to ourselves and to life to bring back the health, to bring back the circulation, to bring them back into the circulation of our unconscious and conscious mind, and not hold them as scars and then project them onto everybody else, giving everybody else a hard time because we had a hard time. So we just keep the thing rolling, mostly because we don't notice the scars in our and the battle wounds in our conscious, unconscious mind and memory. But as they come up in the context of our watching awareness, our observing awareness, something happens that's very interesting. If we pay attention, we can sense that I am bigger than the story, because there's a watcher here allowing the unthinkable, allowing the difficulty, allowing the scars to be observed and seen, allowing the memories to come up. But as there's a watcher, as I am watching these things coming up, it means I am not the things that are coming up. It means that there is a bigger context for these memories, that they can be held within a bigger context. And that's a liberating itself, a very liberating understanding. I can look at something, so I am not just the thing I'm looking at. If I can look at something, then I can contain it, so I'm not it. And it's a very important thing, because we identify with these issues. We identify with the judge in us says, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good, and that's me. And there's no doubt about it. I am made like that. And everyone knows it, and I know it, and I behave like that. And it's a self-fulfilling circle. But the minute you can sense, I can stand back and watch the judge, and really he's not me, then something can shift in a very deep way. But not only that, we also notice that these scars, these issues in us, these strong voices, come and go. They're not there all the time. And this too is a very powerful understanding. If we take it right to the end, if we really take it to the end and really understand and really know that these issues, these voices are here a moment and gone a moment, and we take that as the reality, understanding it as it is, we see that how much is there besides them, how much is there behind them, how much they are layers on something else, and how much we as a bigger person can contain them and be all right. They come and they go and they're not us. This has to be really felt. I have to go right to the end with it, but it's a totally transforming path. It's a totally transforming understanding. Sometimes we can ask, well, they don't really feel like that. They don't, it's all very well, and maybe many of you have heard many Dharma talks that says, well, the voice in the mind that says anxiety is no more than a fly on my ear, because that's what the Dharma teachers are saying. Well, that's what one part of my experience is saying, but I can't really believe it because the voice seems so much louder. And I think we have to look a little bit deeper and ask ourselves, what is it that, what did we give to these voices? What sort of power we gave to these voices that made them so loud? And a lot of it is our fear of not giving them up, because we feel we are them, and we're actually more frightened of the unknown, of what life will be like without them, than we are of the voices themselves, even though they're uncomfortable. It's as if we're more attached, for example, to someone brought this up in a group. What do I do with a relationship I have in which all the time someone's pressing my button and I can't get rid of this reaction? Anger, 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 anger. And the question is, are you more attached to the anger than you are to the friend who is generating this? It's the anger that you're attached to, and the friend is just the reason that the pressing of the button, in the context of the relationship, the button is pressed. So if you look at it, it's the anger that we're attached to. We don't want to let it go, because what's underneath may be even worse, and we're not sure. And the unknown is generally more problematic for us than the voices that are known, even if they give us absolute hell. So the implication, though, is very interesting, because if indeed the our scars, our inner patterns can be softened, can be melted, can be made less solid, less loud, less dominant, it hints at a much bigger freedom. It gives us a hint. If that's the case, then everything might be less solid, less... If those things I'm holding so strong are actually not so solid, maybe everything is not so solid. And that's one of the implications of all of this. If we turn to look at something, if we turn to look at something carefully, and anything we look at, it tends to change. It can disappear, it can move. The attention itself melts things. The attention itself, when we turn our attention like a light and watch anything, it begins to move, it begins to change, it begins to soften. So our tool, again and again, is attention. Not attention attention of the kind that says, I don't want this, but just attention. On the contrary, a sympathetic attention. Attention that says, I'm ready for you. I'm ready to look at you. You're a loud voice, but I'm ready. I'm courageous enough, I'm strong enough, I can look at you. I'm here. I'm present. I exist. I can look at these voices. This kind of attention melts these fixed patterns in us, these fixed voices in us. So I want to touch perhaps one of the most difficult issues that all of us face, and someone actually requested me to mention this in the context of this talk as an example, and that's the example of the Holocaust. And I, myself, I can say I come from that whole world of the major scar, shall we say, of the Jewish people, the major wound of the Jewish people. So I come from there myself. One half of my family were killed, murdered, and the other half of the family never said a word all their life about it. And I, as a child, had to pull from them by constant nagging, and they must have been so irritated with me, but constantly, what was going on? Tell me the story. And they never wanted to. Now, for most people, a very big scar of this kind is simply too big to deal with. And it was in the case of my parents. And when the scar, on the same basis of, shall we say, the awareness, when this voice is so strong, is so painful, and the memory is so difficult, then avoidance and denial is a strategy for survival. Legitimate, it's fine, because that's as far as you can go, and you cannot force anybody to say you must do something else, you must open it, if they're not ready. And I had once a group of quite elderly people from the kibbutzim, and this meditation group was sitting every week for 2 years, and we talked a lot about these things. And one man who was 75 years old said, you know, I can do anything you say, I can absorb anything, I can look at anything, I can see any pain, any suffering, the pleasure and the joy too, but the Holocaust is out. The way I can survive my life is by avoiding it. And that's fine. And in fact, in the traditional Buddhist texts, it's even said that this is one of the... when the situation is too big, then you should know that there are times when avoidance is possible and recommended. But you should know when, how, what, and so on. But for those people that are ready and that are courageous, and there are many, and we have one of them in this room, who have been able to go through such an experience and can really open it and look at it and see what it is and bring it back into circulation, it's a radical step to freedom. And Viktor Frankl is an example, but there are many, many others. What it needs is the courage to bring the light onto such a shattering story in the soul. What does it mean to bring the light on it? It means to see how it's manifest in the present moment, in every way that it does. And it will be everywhere. It will be in the actions you do. It will be in the anxiety you feel. It will be in the way that you talk to others. It will be in the way, as we see now, that it's projected into the world and creates conflict and suffering in other people. It will be in that too. It will be in the discomfort It'll be in the lack of joy that you don't know why, and you don't know where the joy is gone. It'll be in the people, it'll be in the family, it'll be in the country, it'll be everywhere. And with courage and just the eye of awareness, of sympathetic awareness, this can be constantly brought up, constantly seen. With the same kind of attitude, I am here, I am steady, I'm all right, and it's my, in a way, duty to clean this thing, to look at it, to see how it comes out into the present moment, and to bring it back into circulation. Not as a scar that I won't talk about, that I won't think about, that will be buried, and I'll just act from it. And so here's an example. It's very painful, but even this example, I think, shows us we need courage, and it's maybe not for everybody, but it shows us that nothing is too difficult. With awareness, everything can be brought back into life, everything can be opened, everything can be step by step, not all at once, not all in the same moment, but bit by bit everything can be brought back to life. And what happens when we do this is that's when we begin to hear the still small voice. Because what's hiding the more subtle voices in us, I would say spiritual voices, are these kind of what are often called in the tradition kilesas. In the Buddhist tradition, never mind, the translation, you can regard it as thieves that steal our spiritual life. They are stories that sit in our memory, in our conscious, unconscious mind, that collect all the kind of psychic energy around them and make it very difficult for us to actually see the still small voice, which is very delicate. Especially at first, it's very delicate. And the only reason we can't hear it is because the others are so loud. The voices of our pain and difficulty, the voices of our history, voices of our memory are so loud. And as soon as they begin to reduce, then it opens a big space. It opens much more space. And we suddenly hear other voices, which are much more delicate. And these are the still small voices. A very good example in Jewish mythology is the story of Eov, Job, which is an amazing story. And I often like to think that the story of Eov, of Job, is really a bit like a story of a difficult Vipassana retreat. I mean, it's going a bit, he goes a bit further, of course. And I don't wish it on anybody. But sometimes it can feel a bit like that, like as if we're total loss. We lost it all. And if you remember the story, he was doing fine out there in ordinary life. He was doing fine. And you know, a rich man, family, respect from the community, he had status, he had career, he had a good job, well loved, and through out of his hands completely, he lost everything, including the ultimate loss, which is his health, and great suffering, tremendous suffering. And what was interesting is that almost the whole book of Job is voices of all his friends trying to help him to explain the situation. And they are exactly the kind of voices that we're hearing here in the small groups trying to explain what's going on. Why is it happening to me? Why do I feel like this? Who is to blame? Maybe I did something wrong. Maybe it's my past. Maybe it's I'm not good enough. Maybe I should be better. Maybe I forgot some respect, some god or some mitzvah that I didn't do. maybe this, maybe that, maybe that. Page after page after page of speculation, of rationalization, of excuses, of this, all on the voices of his friends. And none of them rang true. Nothing in there really made sense to him. The story of the pain, the stories of the pain and its stories that go with it, the fact that there is pain and there is the mind that tries to explain and turn it and think about it and explain it, and the two go together, the pain in the body, the pain in the mind, the pain in the heart, and the confusion, and the, there it is in mythological language. And at the end, in the last two or three sentences of this story, Job, Eov, surrenders. And he more or less says, the whole thing is so much bigger than my pain. And he hears it then in the mouth of God. In other words, he had realization. This voice, the other voice, the still small voice, came to him. He had a realization. Through the pain, he had the realization. And the realization was, the realization, it's not me. It's not me. I can't say I own all of this story. It is something much bigger. As God says to him, you can't even make an itush. You can't even make a mosquito. You don't even know what you are. So what are you trying to, what's all these explanations? What's all this stuff in the mind going around? What do you mean that you're good, you're not good, you're half good, you're better, you're not better? You can't even conceive of what you're doing in this world. How on earth do you think you can answer these things? And this sense of giving up and just saying, it's not me. And the revelation comes. And that's the implication of really understanding some of these voices. It's not only that we can begin to soften them, work with them, and go beyond them and be the watcher of them. They have implication. That is, the implication that if they're not me, then what is me? If I can watch these things that I hold so strong as being me, such as things we talked about, they are me, I know, I act, you know, I do them all the time, they're solid inside me, that's what me is all about. If those voices can be challenged, and you can actually look at them, and they're just passing by, and they're just fluid, and they're just flowing, and one minute they're there, next minute there is the bell that says the end of the session, and it's like a dream, and we're not sure what's the dream, what's not the dream. There is a dream going on somewhere, but it brings us to another realization, step by step, of things that we hold as me are not really me. And that begins to feed into everything. The pain, the voice, and the watcher of the voice. And who's watching the watcher? Because I know there's a watcher, so someone must know, something must know there's a watcher there. And something may know that. I mean, if you just look at anywhere in the consciousness, things begin to move, to soften, to dissolve, to change. And this is the way of liberation. This is the freedom we're talking about. I once asked my professor, 1973 or 4, when I was doing my doctorate, in a really top laboratory in London, medical research laboratory of the government. And I was working there every day for years, doing scientific research. And I was battling with the whole department, and they called me a vitalist, meaning, you know, it's a very, in scientific language, it's a very negative thing to say to somebody. If you're a vitalist, you're really a no-no, you're someone that really shouldn't be here. It's like you believe in spirit. Vitalism is the old word for those that believe there's something else besides materials in the world, right? So I remember battling and talking, there must be something else, you don't see it, what, you know. He said, no, life is molecules. And I got this again and again and again, life is molecules, life is materials, life is molecules. You also, to my professor, yes, I'm made of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and me, Yes, yes, you're made of carbon, oxygen, pachman, you know, chamtan, that's what you are. We know it, we prove it. Look, I can make virus in the test tube. It was for me, it was a very big issue at that time. I was, you know, challenged by this. They were making viruses in the test tube from taking bits of DNA, bits of nitrogen, bits of this, bits of that, putting it in, mixing it up, and making a virus that could infect and cause disease. It was called a living thing. And nevertheless, I challenged all the time. I couldn't accept this. And in the end, well, I remember one day I stopped to challenge it, and I said, okay, all right, life is molecules. All right, it's just molecules bouncing around. That's you. That's me. Okay. But then what's the point of coming to work in the morning? Where am I trying to get to? Where are you trying to get to? Well, what am I trying to become? I agree, I'm molecules. And I was very pleased to read and to study a little bit in the tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, that in a sense the Buddha also said this. He didn't call them molecules, he called them skandhas, he called them different names. And of course, they weren't just materials. He was wise enough, and the culture at the time was wise enough to say, okay, we only have one section, which is material, but we have many other sections, which is molecules of consciousness, molecules of memory and conditioning, molecules of perception, molecules of creation of forms, and so on. So it's not just materials. So, but still, same language there. And the interesting thing is that this model of reality is a kind of teaching vessel to help you understand that wherever you look, there's just things passing by. The molecules are called heaps, piles, collections. We're just collections. When we look at our memories, if we're courageous enough, yeah, my consciousness is made of a collection of memories. If we look at the body, it's made of a collection of elements. So it's radical. It's very radical. It's very freeing. It doesn't hurt us to allow that perception to come in more and more. I don't, I've not met anybody that said, I'm really damaged by understanding that life is freer than I thought it was. Life is flowing, life is more free. There's more space. There's more room to be not only myself, but something unknown, something less known, something less clear. We may not want it to happen all at once, kind of disintegrate in a puff of smoke, but there's something about it which is very, very freeing. Step by step, to take things that we think are solid, and especially these voices, and to begin to disintegrate them a bit, to take them less seriously, to take them less important, to give them less power over us, and to feel that things flow more, are more soft and free and open. And along with this comes the still small voice all the time. And the still small voice is just the voice of something else. And it's very nice that it's still and small. It's very nice that it just comes in little bits. We feel ourselves changed a bit. We feel ourselves less holding on. And a little change happens, a little opening happens. Less holding on. We drop this, and a bit more open. We drop this voice and this pain and this thing that we're holding all the time. Whether it's, whatever it is, we can be holding on to our revelations. We can be holding on to things that we feel are really important to us. They are important. But there's the other side, which is how much are they obscuring something beyond? That they are so strong, they are so fixed in the consciousness that they are obscuring something else. There's a very nice phrase in English which I find incredibly funny. If someone is talking a lot, you can say, I can't get a word in edgeways. Someone is talking non-stop and you want to say something, you can the phrase in English is, I couldn't get a word in edgeways, meaning I couldn't get a word in even if I put it on its edge and try. I find it so funny, the image of taking a word which usually is this, like this or like that, sort of, I can't even if I put it on its edge, I can't get it in because the other guy's talking so much. And I think there's something like that about Koldamama Daka. It's very thin. The still small voice is very thin. And we need to give it space so it can get in kind of edgeways. And it's very small and very quiet. And all we need to do is reduce the volume of the others. With awareness, with sympathy, with understanding. Just reduce the volume of the others and feel the space that opens up for us. Thank you.